Jim O'Flaherty. Welcome to another All About Jack, a podcast feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. Today's show continues to celebrate the fact that this month, October 2015, is the 65th anniversary of the release of the first Narnia story. Last time, when I released a second show in 1 week, I shared the first of a series of programs that focuses on just one of the Narnia books at a time. The roundtable discussion you are about to hear continues with that series, with the spotlight shining on Prince Caspian, the second published Narnia book. If you are listening to this as I release the shows, and Narnia is among your favorite material from Lewis, then you will be pleased to know I'm planning to post the third podcast from this series on Friday. As you will be able to tell at times, this and the other shows were recorded in 2013, while I had released the first program on All About Jack, this and the other five remaining shows in this series were never published here because they were created for another venture that isn't active at the moment. Today's podcast, then, is likely to be new to you. It features Dr. Devin Brown as the special guest. Dr. Brown has been on the show many times, including a special miniseries dealing with The Hobbit that you can find a link to in the show notes. I also have, again, two co-hosts to help with this discussion, Paul Martin from NarniaFans.com and Dr. Crystal Hurd. One final note, you will notice towards the end of this show there is a loss of quality of the audio recording. This was due to unexpected problems with Skype at the time that couldn't be overcome. I hope you don't mind that material being kept in the show because several good points were made. Welcome both Crystal and Paul.
It's my pleasure.
Absolutely. Thank you for having us.
Crystal is an educator and researcher from Virginia, and Paul is the creator of NarniaFans.com and other places online. As with the previous episode, we have a special guest to help us three musketeers discuss our book, which again is Prince Caspian. The guest today is Dr. Devin Brown. Welcome to the show, Devin.
Hey, it's great to be here. Thanks.
Dr. Devin Brown is a Lilly Scholar and Professor of English at Asbury University. Dr. Brown has published numerous essays and scholarly articles on C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien. Additionally, among the books he has published is the following, Inside Narnia, A Guide to Exploring the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe from 2005, Inside Prince Caspian in 2008, and then Inside the Voyage of the Dawn Treader from 2010. Then this year, 2013, if you're listening to it, the same year that we have recorded it, A Life Observed, the Spiritual Biography of C.S. Lewis is coming out in August. It has a foreword by the stepson of C.S. Lewis, Douglas Gresham. Well, now, it's important to realize that, as before, our goal is not to give you an exhaustive look at the book, which wouldn't be possible unless we did several shows that were at least an hour each. Instead, we want to provide some stimulating thoughts on Prince Caspian that includes a summary of the story and background details about the book, as well as questions that we'll discuss at length in a later segment. Now, please notice I did say the book because except for maybe a passing reference to the movie versions, we are focusing on the book. When the previous podcast on The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, we addressed the issue of the reading order of the books. So please give a listen to that program if you haven't already to find out what we had to say. But I'll give you a hint. This is the second program, and we're talking about Prince Caspian. So hint, hint, the second book you should read if you've never read it before would be Prince Caspian after The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. It's time now for the segment we call The Story Behind the Story. Devin Brown will give us some background information about Prince Caspian that either as the listener, if you haven't read it or you plan to read it, some background information, either trivia or about the writing process that Lewis had. Devin, what can you tell us about the story behind the story?
Well, most people know that The Lion, Witch, and Wardrobe came out in October of 1950 in time for the Christmas market. Lewis put down his pen, and literally put down his pen because that's how he wrote his books, about March 1949 on Lion, Witch, and Wardrobe and had finished. And if you are thinking that he just sort of sat down, waited for the first book to come out, read the reviews, and then started writing again, you would be mistaken. It didn't quite work that way. According to Green and Hooper, right after he finished Lion Witch, he immediately begins working on a sequel, right? And all writers who've hit a stumbling block will be very glad to know that Lewis himself hit one. 3 months after he finished Lion, Witch, and Wardrobe, he had written just two chapters of a book that, well, never became a book. He wrote about a story about a boy named Diggory who could understand the speech of animals and trees. And already it sounds a bit corny, right? And while he's building a raft with Polly, the girl next door, Diggory cuts off a branch from an oak tree and he loses his special powers. His godmother, who's a woman named Mrs. Le Fay, mysteriously shows up, appears to understand what Diggory has done, and seems inclined to help. Well, that's as far as he had gotten in about 3 months, and that's as far as he would ever get. He sets that one down and starts something else. Now, Lewis people will know that this fragment of a story is now called the Le Fay fragment, right? And if you have Walter Hooper's Past Watchful Dragons, you can read the story. And it's very refreshing to see, you know, it's not very good, right? And here's Lewis stumbling a bit. Now, let's be honest, he does take the names Diggory and Polly and writes another story about them, you know, the magician's nephew. And there, Mrs. Le Fay is not Diggory's godmother, but his uncle's godmother. And she does have some fairy blood introduced with mortal blood. But anyway, he comes to a dead end. And so he sets off in a different direction. And the story we've been told, and I think it's accurate, is in about 18 months, he sits down and writes like a crazy person from summer of 1949 to winter of 1951. And out come not just Prince Caspian, but The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, Horse and His Boy, and Silver Chair. The title wasn't always Prince Caspian, by the way. The full name of the book, Prince Caspian, The Return to Narnia, was not his first choice. He originally called the story Drawn into Narnia. And if you say that three times fast, it's not a very good title. It's too hard to say. And his publisher said, no, people can't say that. So then he said, okay, how about A Horn in Narnia? And well, that's just not very good. They said, how about Prince Caspian? And he says, all right, that's a good one. But he kept The Return to Narnia to reflect that original emphasis of being drawn into Narnia. So Lewis himself did a fair bit of revision, at least on this one that we know of.
And speaking of that subtitle, this is the only book that officially has a subtitle. The first book and the last book does have whatever it's technically called, a story for children, but that's not officially part of the subtitle, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, and I think what I would say about that is Lewis absolutely says that after he finished the first one, he thought, well, maybe there'd be a sequel or maybe not. And he said when he finished Prince Caspian, he really thought like he might be done. But trust me, he left that door open to bring the two youngest kids back. But anyway, The Return to Narnia makes it sound like it's a two-book combo and we're done with it. So that was part of his thinking at that point.
This portion now is the short summary. Dr. Crystal Hurd is going to give us a summary of Prince Caspian. But before she does that, tell us briefly about your website, Crystal.
Yes, thank you. I actually have a blog and a website, crystalhurd.com, CrystalHurd, and there I blog a lot about Lewis, about aspects of Lewis, sort of applying the things he has written to our modern day conflicts, and sometimes I review books or just discuss different issues that Lewis illuminated in his time that are still very relevant today. Here is the short summary for Prince Caspian, just to give you a view into the plot of the book. Prince Caspian is the second book written for the Chronicles of Narnia. This is noted by the second part of the title, which Devin mentioned, The Return to Narnia. In it, Peter, Susan, Edmund, and Lucy are at a train station awaiting a journey back to school after summer break. All of a sudden, the train station fades away and the children find themselves on a beautiful beach. It's been about a year in English time, but centuries have passed in Narnia. So after some exploring, the children realize that this is the ruins Care Paravel and uncover some of their gifts given to them by Father Christmas in Lion, Witch, and Wardrobe. They come upon a dwarf named Trumpkin, who is almost drowned by soldiers until Susan's arrow scares them away. And after Trumpkin is rescued, he actually narrates the story of Narnia, describing the capturing of old Narnia by the malevolent Telmarine King Miraz, who actually stole the kingdom by murdering his brother. A little nod to Hamlet there. Meanwhile, Prince Caspian, the true heir of Narnia and Miraz's nephew, escapes the castle guided by his tutor, Dr. Cornelius. That night, the queen has finally born a son, and Miraz intends for his child, not Prince Caspian, to inherit the kingdom. Therefore, he plans to kill Caspian. But thanks to Dr. Cornelius, Prince Caspian flees the palace in the middle of the night. Caspian, who's always been fascinated with Narnian legend, bumps his head on a branch and later recovers consciousness in the company of a badger named Truffle Hunter and two dwarfs, Nickabrick and Trumpkin. Caspian quickly affirms his friendship and states that he will lead the charge to free Narnia from Miraz's rule. And Caspian meets many new characters at Aslan's Howl and collaborates with them to develop a plan, including a discussion on whether to use Susan's horn to call for help. So several are dispatched to Caer Pervel, which is where Trumpkin is captured by the Telmarines and later rescued by the children. So Trumpkin and the children weave their way through the forest. Lucy claims to see Aslan, a claim which the other children ignore. And then Lucy eventually insists that they follow her as she is following Aslan. And then later they see Aslan's shadow. So they apologize profusely to Lucy for doubting her. When Peter, Edmund, and Trumpkin first arrive at the Howl, they overhear Nickabrick, a werewolf, and a hag considering the resurrection of the White Witch to help them defeat Miraz. A fight breaks out, and all three of those rebels die, Nickabrick and the werewolf and the hag. So Peter issues a challenge to King Miraz, who basically just accepts it to prove himself against warnings by his lord, Glozell. During the fight, Peter fights very valiantly, wounds Miraz, but while Miraz is recovering from Peter's hit, Glozell accuses Peter of cheating. So once the uproar begins, Glozell stabs Miraz in the back. The Telmarine army is mobilized, and then the army attempts to retreat from the living woods, who have been brought back by Aslan's power, and then forces in Narnia wash the bridge, and the army surrenders. So in the end, Aslan gives the Telmarines an option to return to the other world, the English world where they were from. One man accepts, and then the children realize that they must return to England through the magic door as well. So Peter informs Lucy that he and Susan will never return because they're too old now. So they bid everyone goodbye and walk back through the door and return to the bench in the railway station awaiting the train, just as the book began.
Now, to lead us with the favorite character segment is going to be Paul Martin. But Paul, before you take over, tell us a little bit about Narnia Fans.
NarniaFans.com is a fan site that is one of the world's largest fan sites for the Chronicles of Narnia, with a database of characters, the books, even music that has been inspired by Chronicles of Narnia, the books and the films, as well as artists that have stories about how their songs were inspired by Narnia. And now we'll talk about our favorite characters from Prince Caspian. I guess we'll start with Dr. Devin Brown, our special guest this week. What are your maybe one or two, maybe even three favorite characters from Prince Caspian, and why do you choose them for your favorites?
Well, that's a tough question because they're all pretty great. I'll say this, you know, before we, I don't know if it's technically I can do this, but I really like the character of Lucy in this book, as I did in the first book, right? She plays an interesting role. I don't know if you're ever looking for bad characters, but of course we all like Susan a little worse this time around. And I find both Peter and Edmund to be far more interesting characters this time around. And so those would be my favorites. And I'll leave the other ones that you guys can pick from.
Excellent. Dr. Hurd, what would you say about your favorite characters?
Well, I would have to go with Lucy again. I also like Lucy. And I think, again, she sort of shows us the importance of obedience, even when we can't see the force that sort of guides us. But I also really, really, really love Reepicheep. Reepicheep, he's underestimated because of his size, but his valor is huge. You know, so I think just his commitment and his contribution is far outweighs his size, even when it comes down to losing the tail and all his men, you know, all his mice men trying to say, well, I'll cut off my tail too. You know, just, you know, he's a great character.
And then finally, William.
Well, this hasn't been mentioned, but I know, Paul, you've said to me, and maybe you've said it otherwise publicly, that Prince Caspian is your least favorite from the series. And I've never really thought about it, but in thinking back to when I originally read it, which was in my late teens, early 20s, actually, probably Prince Caspian was a least favorite. But reviewing it now and thinking more about different dynamics, and when you look at the whole story, I don't know if I'd put it still at the bottom per se, but the characters that stood out to me that was interesting, whether they be good or bad, is both Trumpkin and Nickabrick. Of course, Nickabrick is obviously not, you know, on the good side, but they're an interesting contrast. Although one's a red dwarf and one's a black dwarf, they bring some interesting dynamics to the story. Trumpkin, of course, plays bigger roles in the other stories to come, two of them, The Voyage of the Dawn Treader and The Silver Chair. Here, though, it's interesting to where he's still mainly kind of a skeptic, but then he's willing to be obedient even if he doesn't quite understand. He knows the importance of loyalty, and so that's stood out. And then, of course, with Nickabrick, just that kind of negative side, or just it's just like hard to believe that he's, you know, doing or saying some of the things, and you know, somewhat in contrast to what maybe Trumpkin would, but just that, you know, he's like almost a total opposite and such. Other characters, then briefly, Reap Cheap. I enjoy more in, like, say, the next story, The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, but it's interesting here. That stood out in my mind on first read. And then also, Dr. Cornelius was interesting to me, especially when I first read it, and just some of the different characteristics. He doesn't play the biggest role, but he does play an important role, and we're going to talk some about that in our discussion area. But those are my favorite characters.
Excellent. And then we'll go to mine. I definitely would pick out Edmund as someone that saw some very drastic changes from the first story to this one, where he now was the one that was kind of on Lucy's side when people seemed to not be, even though they learned from the professor and from the prior adventures to be so. And I hope we'll talk a bit about that later. And also, on a slightly different note, where I'm going to bring in just a slight bit of the movie, just for probably a more selfish thing, but Truffle Hunter in the film has this amazing voice that is he's voiced by Ken Stott, who also voices Balin, the dwarf from The Hobbit. And he tells one of the stories, one or two stories in The Hobbit film as well. And I just thought that the way in which he delivered the line to Caspian about the horn that he's holding, he says, "Don't you know what this is?" It lent the film a lot more gravity about, like, all right, who is Caspian? What is this horn? And what is the significance of it? And just that voice and that character just added that gave the story an elevated level of depth for me. That was something that Prince Caspian, I never really grasped the depth of the story until really that moment on film, which, being that Caspian was my least favorite of the books, the film elevated it for me in a way that the book couldn't on its own. And that's my take.
Now it's time for the segment called Unique to This Story. We're asking Dr. Brown, what are the unique aspects within the Prince Caspian story? Anything that's only seen in this story or introduced for the first time that you'd like to share?
Well, in a way, this is easy because this is the second book. Later on, things will get repeated again. But here we see Aslan is not necessarily the lion he seemed to be in the first book. The very first thing that Lucy says when she does finally see him about two-thirds of the way through is, "Oh, Aslan, you're bigger." And there's that lovely line, "This is because you are older, little one. Not because you are, I am not. But every year you grow, you will find me bigger." Now, Aslan will take other forms in other books. He'll be a cat, right, in Orson's Boy. He'll appear, well, his size will be kind of disputed in Voyage of the Dawn Treader. If you look at it, he has different size. He seems to be an albatross, also in Voyage of the Dawn Treader. And at the end of Orson's Boy, when he has that sort of moment of revelation, we're not sure what he is. He swirls up into a cloud. But here, for the first time, we get a sense that he's something more than just that lion. We get that in other books, but here we get an explanation for it. You know, "You're bigger, Aslan." And he says, "That's because you are older." And the idea is inserted here, and really only here, in a specific way, that we will perceive Aslan in different ways as we grow ourselves.
We come now to the largest portion of our podcast, and that is a general discussion taking about, we'll see how many questions we get to, at least four or five, I'm sure, regarding the book, pulling out some interesting themes that we hope you can take away with you or be reminded of if you've read the story, of course, encouraging you to read it again. First question here, Dr. Brown, Prince Caspian is one of the most fully developed characters in all the seven stories. While his story does continue in the other books, and you can pull in as you maybe need to compare, but what important aspects of his character do we see in Prince Caspian that may develop more in other stories or is in contrast to them in the other ones?
Yeah, one of the things that I like about Prince Caspian right from the start is his desire, which is one he shared with Lewis, was his longing to be enchanted. The very first thing we hear about him is how he liked those stories that his nursemaid told him of the old times. This will run through Voyage of the Dawn Treader, where he's ready to abdicate his throne and go off over the end of the world with Reepicheep, because this is something he has a deep longing for. And so that's really my favorite aspect of him. He's kind of a reluctant ruler, but he's a very eager believer.
But I think with Caspian, what I really like is the backstory. I think we get, like I mentioned, kind of a nod to Hamlet almost, where you have this, you know, son who is the rightful king. And I think from the get-go, we are cheering for him because he is, you know, trying to be usurped, you know, and in some ways has already been usurped from the throne that's rightfully his. So I think in the fact that Lewis puts him in two of the books, you sort of follow him, and I think when I first read Prince Caspian from the beginning, I was cheering for him. And so I think that's really interesting, is that, you know, Lewis actually does develop a backstory for Caspian, and that sort of leads to some of the later stuff.
Another question here is the role of obedience in Prince Caspian. It's presented much like real life as being somewhat complicated, we might say. Sometimes it's simply a duty. Other times it's more complex. For example, is Lucy supposed to obey her brother even though he has made a wrong decision? What do you think, Devin?
Well, every so often you'll read somebody who talks about the hierarchy in Narnia as though it's simple. We have a high king. Everyone obeys the high king. And if you don't obey him, there's something wrong there. And every time I read one of those things, I go, man, you haven't read very carefully, because the high king gets obeyed, but what if he's wrong? So Lucy was clearly meant to obey Aslan, and she even tells him after Aslan appears to her in the evening time, she comes back and he says he's waiting for us, and if you don't go, I'm going to have to go by myself, right? We see another example of this in Dawn Treader, when Prince Caspian is now King Caspian, right? And he tells everybody on the boat, he says, look, you guys are going back on your own. I'm going to put somebody else in charge. I'm going with Reepicheep in the boat over the way. And they don't let him do that, right? That's not what he's allowed to do. So this idea of hierarchy and obedience is not nearly as simple as some people would have you believe. And I think it's the same in life. I mean, and I'll say this, you know, Trumpkin tries to have a simplistic belief system. He says, well, if the company breaks up, I'll go with Peter because he's the high king and I'll do what he says. And, you know, and his allegiance is to Caspian. But, you know, does Caspian have to obey Miraz? Well, we're meant to think no, because Miraz was a usurper. Well, I can tell you, Caspian's great, 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 somebody great grandfather was a usurper. So, you know, what exactly gave him the exact right to be the rightful king? It's a little more complicated than people think, as it is in our lives.
Yeah, I definitely agree. There are aspects that are clearly black and white, and then there are things to where, you know, we need, you know, wisdom as Christians from the Lord. And if the crowd is doing one thing, and maybe the crowd is, quote, usually right, or you're in among a good crowd, that doesn't mean you just automatically go with it. You need to have personal discernment. That doesn't give you the right to just do whatever you want because, hey, I can do whatever I want. I don't have to, you know, always obey. That's not the point. But it is much more involved. It's not oversimplistic as you're saying that some people might suggest is within the stories.
Yeah, I would agree. And, you know, I know people will have elders in their churches, and you think, well, you obey the elder unless the elder says something that the Bible doesn't say. But sometimes, you know, I'll just say it, sometimes difficult to know what God is saying to you. You know, in the last battle, there's a bunch of Narnians who think they are following what Aslan wants. And of course, it's not Aslan at all. We know that, but they don't. So obedience can be complicated at times. Obviously, sometimes it's quite simple.
A theme that is also found in Tolkien's work, which, of course, he's a friend of C.S. Lewis, that is shown in the character of Meraz, is the notion that a traitor's actions result in some good being done that wasn't his or her intent. In this particular case, he got rid of Caspian's nurse because he wanted to stop the boy from hearing stories about the old Narnia. The outcome of this is actually Caspian getting just the teacher he needed in Dr. Cornelius. Devin, help us explore that theme.
Yeah, I mean, the statement, a traitor may betray himself and do good he does not intend, comes from Return of the King. Gandalf's talking to Pippin, and specifically he's talking about Gollum's actions to lead Sam and Frodo up through a very dangerous pass and hopefully capture them. But in fact, that's the only way they could have gotten into Mordor. Boromir, I think, also was a traitor earlier and did good he did not intend. The company broke up in the exact way it needed to. You could even say that Saruman has become a traitor and he does good he doesn't intend. And of course, in all those events, whether they're in Middle Earth or in Narnia, both authors are evoking what I would call the sovereignty of God, that God's good comes about through good and it comes about through people's wrong actions. So, yeah, I mean, just imagine. I mean, and Caspian, of course, thinks this is just bad. He's lost his nurse. He's missing her. He's crying and he thinks things will never be any good. But because Meraz decides to send away the nurse, Dr. Cornelius shows up. And what? Because Dr. Cornelius shows up. Not only does Caspian get the exact right tutor he needs for the next stage in his development. Surely he needed something more than that nurse at some point. But guess who shows up? Dr. Cornelius shows up and he's got Susan's horn. That's in fact going to call the mighty consorts of Peter the High King and the rest of the Pevensies. And why did he show up with the horn? Well, because Meraz wanted to get rid of the nurse. So it's a lovely structure. And we're meant to think that good comes about through good and good comes about through evil.
My cohorts, any ideas?
One thing real quick. It just reminds me of something that I heard a while back that was only God can take an evil and make good come of it. And it really does show through in a way that I had not even really considered before, which is, Caspian's kind of at his worst at that point, but there is a kind of half Narnian, if you will. They're waiting in the wings to basically be that godsend that he needed to be able to really find Narnia, find true Narnia. And same within The Lord of the Rings, where there are characters that are doing like true evil and their intent is murder and basically dominance. And through that intent, though, a greater power uses them for a much greater good. But it was only through that grace that they were able to. So I really appreciate that outlook on it.
You think of the great rousing of the Ents, right, in the Two Towers. Mm-hmm. And Gandalf will come out. He doesn't come out and say things explicitly too often, but he comes out and says, you know, because Saruman tried to kidnap Merry and Pippin and bring them back here, he's brought them to the very place they would never have come. And because they've come here, they've roused the Ents, and that would have been the only force that could have overthrown Saruman, right? So this idea of a traitor doing good that he did not intend and good coming up out through evil happens over and over.
Well, Prince Caspian showcases several power struggles. There's the tyranny of King Meraz, Caspian as the new king of Old Narnia, and then, of course, there's a challenge between Peter and Meraz. Why do you think Lewis placed these struggles specifically in the book? And do you think it benefits the story?
Well, you know, as Crystal said earlier, this is the most political of all the Narnia stories, and the politics are quite complicated. I'll give a short answer to this one. Maybe everybody else can jump in. But one of my favorite things is Lewis really shows that if you start out by usurping the crown, right, in other words, might makes right. If I can take it, I can, and then you have to follow me. Well, if you read the end of the story, what really happens to Meraz is that his own guys kill him, right? It's not Peter that did him in. His own guys kill him and then cry treachery. And what? He set the example that if you can kill the reigning king and take power from him, well, more power to you. That's how it's done. And, you know, he suggests, well, that's just fine because I did it. Then who's to stop his followers from doing the same thing to him?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, yeah, there's a lot of power struggle in this book, I think more than in any other of the Chronicles that we see. And I think what's interesting is, you know, we sort of, in Lion, Witch, and Wardrobe, we see a land that's been under tyranny for a long time and then has been released. And then as the centuries pass, a new antagonist has come, from the ranks, even from, we find out later, the Telmarines actually came from, from England, from the other world and sort of, corrupted Narnia. So, it's incredibly interesting. I think that all the different struggles, as Devin mentioned, you have Miraz, who is actually killed by one of his own men, who killed Caspian's father so he could take the throne. And so you see a lot of that struggle. I think that it makes the story far more dimensional. And it sort of shows, I didn't read this as a child, but if I had, it sort of showed us that, things are more complicated as Narnia has existed. There are more issues that arise, and Narnia is not immune to those political strife. Humans are humans. So I think it really benefits the book. I think it also shows the depth that Lewis can mine even in a children's story.
And if I can jump in for one more quick answer, one of my favorite power struggles is actually the one between the High King and his Lord Aslan, right? Certainly Aslan mm-hmm. is over the High King. And yet when Peter comes, he wants to impose his own view of what Aslan should be. Aslan can't be invisible because he was never invisible in the first book. So, he's never acted like that before. And the suggestion is, and he has to continue acting as the way he did the last time we were here, right? Mm-hmm. And so here's the High King, rather than submitting to whatever Aslan decides, sort of setting up his own limitations on Aslan. Well, fortunately, that doesn't last very, very long. In that famous chapter of the High King in Command, the very first thing he says to Caspian is, "We don't know where Aslan is. We don't know when he will act." And here's one of my favorite lines: "In his time, no doubt, not ours." So he's learned that lesson that Aslan will act in his way, not Peter's way. And Peter's only proper action is to submit to that. And of course, at the very end, he has that secret talk with Aslan that none of us have heard, even Lucy, right? Although we get a suggestion. We get to hear Aslan's secret talk with Lucy at the end of Dawn Treader. But anyway, when they said he can't come back, never. You two are, answers Peter. At least that's what he said. I'm pretty sure he means you to get back. Oh, Peter, what bad luck. Can you bear it? I think I can. And here's the line. It's all rather different from what I thought. In other words, again, Aslan has explained, you don't limit me. I've got plans, and the way I'm working them out, sometimes you'll understand them, sometimes you don't, but the proper mode at all times is acceptance. So anyway, that power struggle is one of the more interesting ones that I think is in the book.
Yeah, one of the things that you just mentioned, Devin, I was going to bring out in the first part of the chapter 13, the High King in Command, is his comment about, "We don't know when he will act," of course, referring to Aslan, "in his time, no doubt, not ours. In the meantime, he would like us to do what we can on our own." And I think that draws, moving somewhat beyond the question at hand, but that spoke to me in terms of reminding me that, as a Christian, that there are times in which you see the Lord maybe working solely on his own, but oftentimes he uses individuals or your own actions to carry out his will. You're not just to sit there like in the story. Peter just said, say, okay, let's sit here and wait to see what Aslan's going to do. No, it's like, let's go ahead and do what we know we can do, or what he would have us to do, without being rash, of course.
Yeah, you really see that in the chapter where they get lost in the woods and they're trying to find their way out. There's a lot of bickering between the four monarchs, which is important because Lewis believed in shared power and checked power. So you see a lot of the back and forth between which way should we go, who should we follow, should we follow the river. There's a lot of that back and forth that sort of introduces, I think, to a young reader, the complexities of power and leading and who should lead.
Yeah, and I want to add something to William's point. He read that passage. In the meantime, Asa would like us to do what we can on our own, and that's really a bit of a difference, although you could actually say it's going further down what we saw in Lion Witch. But, you know, when Peter says it's all rather different from what I thought, I mean, I think that's what growing up looks like, right? Old mm-hmm. expectations are overturned, new ways of seeing. And then one of the most significant changes is that instead of calling for help, the children are the help in this one, right? And I think Lewis's point is that that's kind of how it works, right? The four Pevensies depended on Asim for help. He now increasingly depends on them to serve as his agents in providing help. And I think Lewis would say that's the way it kind of is as we all grow as well.
That's a great point, Devin, because you notice that there's a lot more assistance from Aslan in the beginning, you know, in Lion, Witch, and Wardrobe. And then you see sort of this weaning off of power, you know, Peter fighting the wolf, you know, in the first book and, you know, sort of, and then being told, oh, make sure to clean off your sword. You know, there's this weaning off of power, right? And then you really don't see Aslan till, you know, several chapters into the second book. It's almost like Aslan is training them, you know, to lead on their own or not to depend so heavily upon him solely, to sort of delegate that some of that powers to them and for them to do the work, some of the work.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. And then it says when she first sees him, you know, I thought you'd come roaring in and frighting all the enemies away like last time.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, it's not going to work like that this time. And mm-hmm. that's how it's supposed to work again.
Right.
Also reminds me of the scouring of the Shire where Gandalf tells the four hobbits, you know, you're quite grown up now. That's what you've been trained for. You'll find you don't need me. You're supposed to go and do this.
It also kind of reminds me of the Acts of the Apostles. They have to mm-hmm. go and act now. And they don't necessarily have Christ in physical form. They have the Holy Spirit now, just in the way that they've been sent out. And in the same way, the Pevensies kind of have been sent out. And just like the hobbits getting back to the Shire, and they know that they have to do it, you know. It all kind of coalesces like that. It's
so finding one's independence,
mm-hmm.
you know, growing, like Devin mentioned.
Well, this leads naturally into some of the comments already, into one of the questions that we had, and that is the concept of strange help. The promise of Susan's horn is that the help of some kind or strange help will result, and indeed that is what occurs. Caspian was looking forward to having four adults come and help, but instead he's aided by four children. Devin, if you could comment further about that.
Yeah, I mean, this comes from Trumpkin's first response after he's convinced that they are the Pevensies. He says, you know, we're awfully fond of children and all that, but, you know, just at the moment we're in the middle of a war, I'm sure you understand, right? And he doesn't get that they are the help, right? And Paul, you can check me if I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure that when they show up and Caspian sees them and he says, what were you expecting? And I think he says in the movie, someone taller. Does that ring a bell?
I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought you'd be a little taller.
I thought you'd be a little taller, yeah. And so, yeah, they were expecting a different kind of help. And let's go back to when Dr. Cornelius gave Caspian that horn. He hands it to him and says, it's said whoever blows it shall have strange help. No one can say how strange, right? The idea that when you blow it, it's not like a vending machine where you're going to get, you know, the peanut M&Ms you asked for. You're going to get what you need, not necessarily what you think you need. And remember when Father Christmas gave Susan that horn, right? He says, when you put this horn to your lips and blow it, then wherever you are, I think help. And he says, of some kind will come to you. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the way Susan is later, I almost think she should have just stopped him and say, Father Christmas, what do you mean of some kind? What is this of some kind stuff, right? Why can't I have just regular help? And, of course, when she blows her horn the first time, the wolf's there, and who shows up? You know, her brother who's never used that sword ever, right? This is my help, my brother with his new sword. Holy moly, right? He would have said, it's going to come, but oh no, it's Peter with the new sword. So this idea of help that fits. And I guess I would say that a great deal of the aid in Caspian is that sort of strange help, this kind of help that only looks like help when you look back on it. You know, we mentioned the mm-hmm. exile, Caspian's nurse, even the thunderstorm he rides out on that sends him into his accident, that means that he is rescued by Trumpkin and Truffle Hunter. Rowan up Glasswater Creek, if they had gone a different way, they would have been captured by the sentries there. And, strange help. Lewis says this. He says, God sends us help, the kind that we need. It may not be. Often we'll say, gosh, that's the worst thing that could have happened to me. And then looking back later, you go, no, that was the best thing that could have happened to me. I'm sure Eustace was thinking that after he got turned into a dragon. But that kind of strange help in his life turned out to be the exact kind of help he needed.
This is kind of a side note, but we mentioned Reepicheep earlier and sort of underestimating someone's contribution because of their size. I think that actually happened several times in this book. For example, when they meet Trumpkin, they call him DLF, which is Dear Little Friend. But he's, the one that kind of helps them, get through the woods and sort of aids them in the battle and stuff, And then, here's Reepicheep. And you mentioned, Devin, I wasn't expecting children. So I think almost everyone, even the kings and queens of Narnia are misjudged, for something else because of their size. So it's a really interesting concept, which he weaves through several characters in this book.
Yeah, and I was going to suggest, this is one of Lewis's favorite themes. In Letters to Malcolm, he writes, "It seems to me we often almost sulkily reject the good that God offers us because at that moment we expected some other good." And of course, we see this in Perelandra, right? Mm-hmm. The Green Lady, the queen of that world, explains, "One goes to the forest to pick food. Already the thought of one fruit rather than another is grown in your mind. Then it may be one finds a different fruit, not the fruit one thought of. One joy was expected, another was given. If you wished, you could send your soul after the good you had expected instead of turning it to the good that you had got. You could refuse the real good. You could make the real fruit taste insipid by thinking of the other." And of course, by the way, as you mentioned, Crystal, Lucy's guilty of this herself, right? She falls prey to limiting help to the kind that she's been expecting instead of being open to the kind that was sent. She complains, really, to Aslan, "Well, I thought you'd come roaring in, frighten the enemies away like last time." Well, that's not the good he's bringing this time. He's going to wake up the naiads and dryads, and it's going to be accomplished, but in a different way, not the way that Lucy was imagining.
Yep, he comes riding in on a donkey with palm branches waving, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's different.
Different kind of question here, and that is, at the beginning of the story, and even in later, I guess, because Paul had come up with this question, I maybe can have him comment further or clarify here, but Peter, Susan, Edmund, and Lucy, they learned many lessons in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, but it seems, especially at the beginning again of Prince Caspian, they've forgotten them all. For instance, Lucy found Narnia. No one believed her. Then in Prince Caspian, Lucy sees Aslan later, and they don't believe her. Is this an oversight by Lewis, or, why does it come across this way?
In the book, when Lucy meets Aslan again, she says, "But they won't believe me." And that really struck me, that why wouldn't they believe her? Like, why would she have doubts that her family would believe her? Why would she still, after what happened with the adventure, basically? Why would they go on to basically prove her right, that they kind of don't believe her because they don't see him themselves?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. What I like about it is it really gives, it keeps everything from being oversimplistic. And the oversimplicity avoids is having a single character arc, like a character begins ignorant and ends up knowledgeable, and that's end of the story, drive safely, see you next week. I mean, so these characters learn that lesson, but then they have to learn it again. So picture this. Someone doesn't believe in Christ. They don't believe in the supernatural. They come to faith. They go to church, and then they decide, okay, this is how faith works. Well, those of us who have been believers all our lives know that, well, there's another relearning and another relearning. Oh, this is how it works. No, this is how it works. No, and anytime we think we've got it all figured out, that really means we're just in line to have to figure it all out again. And the first couple times it happens, we're very resistant. We think that our little denomination, that's exactly how salvation works, and it can work no other way because this is the way it works. That's the way I learned. And you're very, very resistant, even though you know that you just did it to say, well, there's no such thing as the supernatural. And then you come to believe in God and you say, okay, now I know how it is. We keep wanting to do that. And Lewis himself talks about that our sort of false limiting images of God have to be destroyed and recreated again and again. It's not just a single character arc for each of us, but it's an ongoing one.
Well, this makes me think it hits it from a kind of a different angle, but that is, you know, each story, which I don't think we've commented yet, is very different. And in fact, if there was any kind of formula during the time when Lewis was writing this, you know, had he read it and, okay, you have to do a children's story this way, you better have all your characters that you started out in book one in every single book that you write about. He, you know, broke that rule. And, you know, and it kind of cuts maybe both ways. For some people, they maybe don't enjoy some of the other books because it is very different from some of the others. But I think it adds to the storytelling, as well as just shows the how versatile and how creative Lewis was by being able to, you know, do that and have a successful series.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll say this. One of the biggest problems with writing a book and then trying to write a sequel is when the sequel is not as good as the first. We see that happen over and over again. And if you do happen by some miracle to have a second book that's pretty good, surely the third one isn't going to be as good. And I'll just mention this, the original Superman series with Christopher Reeve. One pretty good, two not so good, three a disaster, right? And Lewis had watched his friend J.R.R. Tolkien, right, have the same problem. He writes The Hobbit way back in 37, gets it published. It's a pretty good success. They want a new Hobbit. They want another adventure with Bilbo. And, you know, he's got the inklings there, and they all convince him, and he's convinced himself that what? No more adventures for Bilbo. There's nothing more to be said. I've got to do something different, right? So it's going to be Frodo who takes over. So the new Hobbit literally is a new Hobbit. Lewis knew this also himself. He sends Ransom to the planet Mars in a human spacecraft. In the second book, he's going to send him to Venus, but in this sort of ice chest kind of thing, and have a very different kind of setting. So, you know, it's got to be a little bit of the same, but it also has to be quite different. So, yes, he's going to send the four children back, but at a very different time and a darker time, not the same kind of time at all. And they're all going to play different roles. And I think one of his genius moves was to not send Susan and Peter back for book three and not even send Edmund and Lucy back for book four. He kept them fresh. And I will just say this. You know, I teach a class on Lewis, and I've never found a Chronicle of Narnia that isn't somebody's favorite. Right. Mm-hmm. So the consensus is that while everyone's going to like one more than another and think maybe this is my least favorite, there is no consensus about which is everybody's most favorite or least favorite. And I think that's the mark of a very successful series.
And then finally, well, one last question here, and this comes from Crystal. We may have her comment first and then you, Devin. That is, what dynamic does Nickabrick and the old hag bring to the story? Do they represent the modern day skeptics?
You know, I think it's very interesting. And I love what Lewis does with this. He shows, you know, centuries of history in Narnia. So you see, you know, sort of the fruits of specific leadership or what have you. And it, I think that's a really neat scene where the children go down and they sort of see themselves as part of the Narnian legend. So you see the progression of time. And when they're discussing, you know, at the how, like what they're going to do, Nickabrick says, "To speak plainly, your wallet's empty, your eggs addled, your fish uncaught, your promises broken. Stand aside then and let others work." So it sort of shows that they're not trusting Aslan after, you know, all the things these children have been through, and they've basically come through time to save Narnia. It's you sort of see, again, that skepticism that's still alive in parts of Narnia.
And if I can add something to Crystal's point, you know, she makes a very good point that Nickabrick's ready to bail. But in actual fact, what he's really saying is that since Aslan has not acted within the time limits that Nickabrick had set up, mm-hmm. then he's not going to act. And of course, this is the opposite that Hiking Peter comes to learn. We don't know when he will act in his time, no doubt, right? And I guess one of my other favorite lines from Nickabrick is he's ready to say, well, let's try something else. When your sword breaks, you draw your dagger. As though these great powers, you know, first Aslan and then the Hag's going to call up the White Witch, as though they're available for him to use as he likes, as weapons that will further his own cause. When you read that Hideous Strength, Lewis talks about a group of mortals who try and draw strength on some supernatural agency to further their cause. And he shows us that in fact, it's the mortals who get used by the supernatural causes. And so had the Hag succeeded in calling up the White Witch, it wouldn't have turned out anything at all like Nickabrick thought.
Well, as we wrap up this part of the discussion, Devin, do you have any other thoughts or comments to leave us regarding Prince Caspian?
Yeah, I got to tell you something. There is, at the ending of Prince Caspian, Lewis does something, and I think very few readers get it. They come back, and they're sitting there on the gray, gravelly surface of a train platform at a country station. The luggage is scattered around them, and they're sitting as if they had never moved from it. And Lewis says, it was a little flat and dreary for a moment after all they had been through, but also unexpectedly nice in its own way. We begin the story with them all gloomy about going back to school and life here is dreary. And they come back and they've learned lots of things. But one of the things they've really learned is to see there's actually something extraordinary in this ordinary surrounding. What ordinary surrounding? That it was nice in its own way, with the familiar railway smell, the English sky, and the summer term before them. And you know, Lewis touches on it very lightly, and if he hadn't written elsewhere, we might have kind of let it go. But if you read the very end of The Silent Planet, where Ransom goes to Mars and then comes back, the very last line there, he has a very similar return home. It's been quite incredibly adventurous, particularly the return home trip, right? One of the most, you know, dramatic returns you'd ever have. He gets out, and there's the lovely smell of the English rain, and he walks into a pub, and he says, a pint of bitter, please. And Lewis is suggesting that, I think he's afraid that we're going to find our own lives boring compared to the lives of the Pevensies, and that the Pevensies are going to find their own real lives boring compared to where they've been. So Lewis has that kind of answer at the end of Out of the Planet, and he also doesn't want the Pevensies or his readers to think our world is boring compared to Narnia. That would be a mistake. He's written about the boy's book, where this boy rides the unrideable horse and solves the mystery. And think of the Hardy Boys, right? Where those boys were in middle school, they couldn't drive a car yet, but they would like fly airplanes and pilot subs. You know, and I'm now doing my paper route, and these guys are catching international spies. Of course my life seems boring. Right? But he doesn't want that to happen. There's this lovely line, and this is what I'll close with. He says, when you read this certain kind of book, and he means a certain kind of, we mean Narnia, of course, when we read of enchanted woods, we do not despise real woods because we've read of enchanted ones. No, the reading makes all real woods enchanted. And so at the end of Prince Caspian, when the four Pevensies come back to our world, well, so do we. But instead of finding it boring and lackluster and not nearly as cool, we find there's something special. There's something extraordinary in that ordinary. There's what I would call a sacramental ordinary sense there. There's something holy and special about the most common thing, about what? The railway smell, the English sky, and the summer term before us.
I'm William O'Flaherty. I'm afraid that's all that was recorded on this second show. As noted at the start, there were unexpected problems with Skype near the end of the time the show was recorded. I hope you didn't have too much difficulty following along to understand what was being shared over the last several minutes. The special guest for today's show was Dr. Devin Brown, author of many Lewis and Tolkien-related books. You can check the show notes for links to some of them and search my website to find the others. You will also find a link to NarniaFans.com that Paul Martin oversees, as well as a link to Dr. Crystal Hurd's website in those show notes. You can find these notes either at EssentialCSLewis.com or AllAboutJack.podbean.com. The Podbean location is where the audio files are hosted directly. Podbean is spelled PODBEAN. Again, that's AllAboutJack.podbean.com. If you go to the other location, EssentialCSLewis.com, you can still get to this podcast. Plus, I have a variety of other articles there as well, including a series examining quotations alleged to be from C.S. Lewis. I hope you enjoyed today's show enough to want to share it. Also, feel free to leave comments about the program online and consider listening to other shows. Recently, I've been focusing on Narnia with many shows related to that theme in one way or another. I hope you will also consider other Lewis-related topics that include recent conversations I had about two books. They were C.S. Lewis's List, and another is called C.S. Lewis and His Circle. Again, you can hear those and others by either going to EssentialCSLewis.com or AllAboutJack.podbean.com. If you have questions or comments, you can email them to info at EssentialCSLewis.com. Again, that's info, I-N-F-O, at EssentialCSLewis.com. Finally, did you know that you can help make sure this podcast is freely available to all? Consider becoming a financial supporter of this podcast to make sure it continues. There's a link in the show notes about this. Contributions can be as little as a dollar a month. There are many great rewards possible, and no long-term commitment is necessary.